This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
My name is Lynn Arnold. I'm the Chief Executive of Anglicare South Australia, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon to the Joy McClellan oration as part of the Festival of Ideas. Joy McClellan was a noted early chief of predecessor organisations to Anglicare, and in fact had filled that role for 46 years until she retired in 1975. She was awarded an OBE in 1963 and recognised for great significant work throughout her time with Anglicare, but also for the changes that she wrought upon that organisation in its way to help meet community need. When she died in 1993, Anglicare inaugurated the Joy McClellan Oration in her honour, and we are very pleased to have that oration as part of the Festival Ideas in recent years. And particularly pleased that today we have Professor Raymond Guyter as the orator for the Joy McClellan Oration for 2009. It is my great pleasure to introduce him and to chair this session. And I know that we are all very much looking forward to hearing him speak on the idea of absolute value. But as we were discussing just beforehand, perhaps we're also wanting to know, as he said he heard in a function in Melbourne, how the little boy in Romulus, my father, turned out. When I was preparing for this, I thought, well, I had better read some of his works, and I must say that The Philosopher's Dog is a fascinating book. I then got onto Good and Evil and Absolute Conception, and I was suddenly reminded of that Tony Hancock program many years ago, which some of you may know, when he's trying to read Bertrand Russell, and the entire half-hour episode is such that he never gets off the first page. And I was then also daunted by the fact that I had once read a book by Jacques Derrida, and as I was reading it the first time, feeling that I was not making much progress, but it would be okay, I would understand more on the second reading of the book. In fact, on the second reading, I understood less than the first. And so it was when I started reading Good and Evil and Absolute Conception that I found it something I had to keep rereading. But what I found out of that was a wonderful tapestry of ideas, which is why it is such a difficult read, because so many different ideas come together, woven together in a tapestry that helps give understanding to concepts of morality, understanding to concepts of good, understanding to concepts of what it is to be the sacred, and to desecrate what we actually mean when how can we think about somebody who is dead, that we can actually desecrate the memory of somebody who is dead. So there are many of these issues that come through, and I strongly recommend it to you, but I know that we will hear something of that in his lecture today. Professor Guyter is Foundation Professor of Philosophy at the Australian Catholic University and Professor of Moral Philosophy at King's College, London. He is a Fellow of the Australian Academy of Humanities. He is married to Yale, who is a teacher at the King David School, where she teaches Hebrew, and they have two children, Katerina and Eva, and two stepchildren, Dahlia and Michelle. Professor Guyter is here to challenge our thinking, pushing the limits of ideas. Would you please welcome, in his discussion of the idea of absolute value, Professor Raymond Guyter.
And four grandchildren now, too. So. thank you very much. It's an honour to give this oration. It could have gone in a number of directions, some more concretely concerned with social policy, but I hope the direction it's taken is one that Joy McClellan would find congenial. I have to apologise, I'm not feeling very well, so I was going to say, if you can't hear me, but this sounds like a very good setup. But I hope you'll forgive me if I'm in about 5 minutes, I think, over. You're putting, you can't hear, if you run 5 minutes over time. Well, Good and Evil was published about 20 years ago, and reading reviews and comments about it, I was often struck by how few people noticed the indefinite article, Good and Evil and Absolute Conception. And when I read the title of this talk in the program, the idea of of absolute value, accurately reproduced, I have to say, as I sent it, I realized with some anxiety that I must have suffered a very senior moment, because I haven't changed my mind about that indefinite article. There are many ways of speaking about absolute value, and they've made themselves heard in various ways in different strands of the religious and ethical traditions of the West. I don't speak of others. I was also struck, reading reviews and listening to comments, that nobody complained that the book didn't elaborate and defend the claim that there are some things that must not be done, whatever the circumstances or consequences. That's what people commonly take the claim that there are values that are absolute really to mean, and indeed I did so at one stage. In an era when philosophy was the era when I was growing up intellectually, an era when philosophy was thought to be conceptual analysis, when books were written, every second book was called The Concept of This or That, The Concept of Mind, The Concept of Morality, The Concept of Education, and so on. Gilbert Ryle said that philosophers, what they're best at is mapping out a conceptual landscape. Now, it's not generally true that philosophy does this, but I think it is one of the distinctive tasks of philosophy to delineate the conceptual structure of elements of a common understanding, to place them in a conceptual space that reveals that structure more perspicuously, in part by revealing the relation of elements to one another. And that's what I will try to do today. I offer only a sketch. I hope, though, it might guide you to places where you can stop and take a view and question me about what's to be seen there, or even to ask me where the hell you are once you've followed that path. When I was a student, I was preoccupied with the lessons of Stalinism and Nazism, like many students of my generation then on the left, and I sought with a kind of sense of urgency to discover a humane socialism. And that, I thought, would be possible only if people accepted that there were some things that could not be done, whatever the circumstances or consequences. Everybody then was talking about whether ends justify the means and so on. At the same time, when I was trying to convince my friends that there were some things that morally one must not do, whatever the consequences, I read Hannah Arendt's account of the trial in Jerusalem in 1961 of Adolf Eichmann, one of the chief architects and executioners of the Final Solution. It had a profound effect on me in more ways than one, but most of all because of something that occupies, in fact, only a few lines in her book. In those lines, she records an inspired intervention by the presiding judge of the time, Moshe Landau. Against those who wished to make a show trial of it, Landau was moved to say that the trial had one and only one purpose, to do justice. From one perspective, his point was about the procedures that are necessary to preserve the integrity of the court. From another, and of course these perspectives don't conflict, he gave voice to one of the most sublime features of our system of criminal justice. Justice was owed to the chief architect of the Final Solution, Landau said, not just for the sake of future legal or political goods, not just to avoid slippery slopes, but because it was owed to him as a human being, I'm tempted to say, even though there was no doubt whatsoever about his identity or about his terrible guilt. Only if justice were done for that reason, amongst others, would it be done at all. Only then would the integrity of the court remain intact. That is anyhow how I read Landau's remarks. When they captured Saddam Hussein, I remember saying to my wife, I don't think Saddam will find his Moshe Landau, and it proved to be true. Well, we have grown accustomed to the idea that justice is owed to every human being, irrespective of who they are, what they've done, and what attitude they take to what they've done. Some people disagree, of course, but the matter is at most controversial for us. Aristotle, who is so much admired by contemporary philosophers, would have found it absurd, and in a way he would have been right. In my work, I've tried to reclaim the wondrousness of it for philosophical reflection. Thinking about Landau's intervention, and I've been doing it for a large part of my intellectual life, My attention shifted from rules or principles that prescribe or prohibit conduct to how one could elaborate the belief that justice was owed to Eichmann for his sake. How to elaborate the belief that even he would be wronged if his trial were treated merely as a show trial. To put it another way, my attention shifted from a concern over what it is wrong to do to an attempt to understand what it means to be wronged. We express the importance of what it means for us to be wronged when we emphasise that to be wronged is to suffer harm different from and in addition to, not reducible to, other forms of harm, physical and psychological, that we suffer when we are wronged. It's not the money you stole, we say. What matters is the principle. You betrayed me. Indigenous peoples of colonised lands ask for an apology from governments under which they live, because I think, in addition to the material and psychological misery of dispossession and its consequences, they suffer an injustice. They suffer the injustice of that as a distinct and irreducible source of pain and humiliation. As well as suffering the most terrible physical and psychological harm, victims of torture, to anticipate something I'm going to discuss later, victims of torture also suffer the evil of what was done to them, the terrible wrong of it, as a distinct and irreducible source of their torment. It is, I believe, an element of their torment that can't be explained fully by elaboration on their physical and psychological suffering and their pained incredulity that anybody could be so untouched by the natural sympathy that most people have for the suffering of their fellows. Landau was a German Jew, deeply immersed in the traditions of German jurisprudence, as it was influenced by the great philosopher Immanuel Kant. In interviews, he spoke in Kantian idioms of the inalienable dignity possessed by every human being and the unconditional respect owed to them. It's Kant, rather than Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill, the father of the form of consequentialism we now know as utilitarianism, who has haunted my thought. And many who have never heard of Kant will have heard his most famous formulation of what he called the categorical imperative, that one should never treat persons merely as ends, but always as an end in themselves. That one should never treat persons merely as means to one's ends, but always as ends in themselves. The Australian philosopher Alan Donegan said that in that formulation, Kant was trying to render, in a way he believed to be more perspicuous to reason, the moral content of the biblical command to love one's neighbour. Donegan formulated the positive aspect of it thus, quote, "Always act so that you respect every human being, yourself or another, as a rational creature." End of quote. Were someone to ask me whether Kant had succeeded in the ambition that Donegan attributes to him, I'd say that he had not. Indeed, it's a profound question whether Kant was even on the right track or whether this great philosopher got things backwards. How, I wondered, could the thought that one had failed to respect someone as a rational creature, a rational being indeed, for on this view you don't even need to be a creature, how could that inform a person who is seriously remorseful, perhaps for betraying someone, or for having tortured them? Could a remorseful torturer capture the terrible wrong he'd done his victim by saying, "My God, what have I done? I failed to respect a rational being"? Is that a cheap shot? I don't think it is. At any rate, an account must be given, surely, as to why, at one of the most critical moments of moral sobriety, one of the most sober moments of the moral life when a person is lucidly remorseful, Kant's account of the matter looks like a parody. Dignity, the kind explicitly or implicitly with a capital D, or inalienable dignity, is a word that occurs often in preambles to international law and in defences of it. Recently, for example, those who defended the absolute prohibition of torture, as that's expressed most forcibly in the Convention Against Torture and other forms of cruel and degrading treatment, appealed to it against those who've argued that the law should permit the torture of suspected terrorists in certain circumstances because morality and responsible politics requires it. Those preambles are often influenced by Kant, to my mind, in fact, the greatest of moral philosophers after Plato. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948 speaks in its preamble of the, quote, inherent dignity of all members of the human family, and, quote, of the dignity and worth of the human person. In Article 1, the Declaration proclaims, all human beings should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. The preamble comments of both the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights of 1976 and the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights echoes the Universal Declaration in speaking also of the inherent dignity of all members of the human family. It then goes on to say, I quote, these rights derive from the inherent dignity of the human person. The Convention Against Torture speaks in the same way of inalienable rights that derive from the inherent dignity of the person. Kant, in fact, seldom used that word, but for reasons that anybody who knows his work, I think, are clear, the Kantian ring of those expressions is clearly audible. And as I said, it was very significant that Landau, speaking in interviews later about the Eichmann trial, constantly referred to the idea that even people like Eichmann possess an inalienable dignity to which one owes a respect that is unconditional. Well, the dignity to which expressions like inalienable or inherent dignity refer is not the dignity that people seek to retain when, for example, they ask to die with dignity, spared of the humiliations that attend some illnesses. That dignity is alienable, essentially connected as it is with a person's demeanour in the face of affliction. The connection between dignity and a person's demeanour can, of course, carry over to situations in which a person can no longer has a demeanour, when she's dead or in a coma, for example, and in which we're concerned that nothing should be done that would, in the ordinary circumstances of living, constitute humiliation for her. It goes with, perhaps is an aspect of, the heroic and the noble, and it's those resonances, I suspect, resonances of the heroic and the noble, that explain its appeal. Though it's often invoked when a person has lost or is threatened with the loss of all visible dignity, it keeps that person in the same conceptual moral space as the concept that marks what she's lost. For it is, I said, an expression in the key of the noble, of the heroic. That being so, it's easy to see why it's often deployed in struggles against oppression, especially oppression which is premised, as racial oppression is, on disdain, sometimes contempt for the oppressed. It's also easy to see why it's so well suited to the idea of inalienable rights, for that too is a concept in the key of the heroic. I call these expressions, inherent inalienable dignity, or the unconditional respect that is owed to it, or the expression people as ends in themselves, I call these terms of the middle ground, or for short, middle terms. On the one side are ways of speaking that are steeped in a sense of the importance to our moral and political thought of our humanity, and of different forms of human fellowship, as when we speak of a common humanity, or say that to do such and such would be to treat someone as less than fully human, or when we speak of the human family, or when in political context we speak, as the preambles to human rights law often do, as I've shown, of the brotherhood or the sisterhood, and so on. These are ways of speaking whose resonances and tones derived from the richness of a natural language and the art that's made possible by it, language that shaped by and shapes the lives of peoples. To use such terms and reflection on their use is necessarily in medias res, in the midst of things. Our sense of them is somewhat sometimes deepened and sometimes cheapened by art. Someone who seeks to see things from the point of view of the universe, as philosophers so often strive to do, will try to jettison it. And that's because, as my quotation to the preambles of the Declaration of Human Rights and others suggest, these middle terms mingle too well, indeed, mingle incorrigibly, one might say, with ways of speaking that appear to tie our moral thought to the conditions of our humanity, to our responsiveness to what we have made of the defining facts of the human condition, to our mortality, our sexuality, our vulnerabilities and misfortune. Indeed, the very expression of the human condition seems to speak of those big facts in an accent of pity. On the other side of these middle terms, terms like inalienable dignity, are the expressions that aspire to their philosophical elaboration, intended to make their real content, and therefore the proper basis of their authority, perspicuous to reason. In the Kantian tradition, the elaborations refer, as we've seen, to rational agency and the kind of respect that is owed to it. And that tradition looks with suspicion, if not actual hostility, on the power of those middle terms, the power that they've achieved on account of their engagement with ways of speaking that express and celebrate human fellowship. From the perspective of that tradition, that power looks just like rhetorical power in the pejorative sense of that phrase. Kant, indeed, is a magnificent example of a philosopher who believes, as indeed the mainstream of the philosophical tradition believes, that when we think about the great matters of morality and politics, the cognitive content of our thought, the content that is strictly answerable to reason and to truth, should always be, in principle, extractable from, and now I intend this in the broader sense, the literary form of its expression. Only when it's extracted from that form can it be subject to the critical scrutiny of a philosophy that aspires to see things from the point of view of the universe. Only then, this thought continues, can we accept that cognitive intellectual content, the content of reason, with a clear intellectual conscience. Deep though that thought goes in philosophy and in much else in our intellectual tradition, it misrepresents things. Our use of the expressions in our natural language from which I've claimed the middle terms gain their power is subject to a discipline achieved by the application of a range of concepts that tell us when we can trust the way we've been moved by them. Those concepts define, for a certain way of thinking, a distinctive sensibility and a distinctive way of trying to see things as they are, rather than as they might appear to us for a variety of bad reasons. We acknowledge that we're answerable to those concepts when, for example, we try to avoid sentimentality or refuse to yield to a disposition to pathos, or when we try to resist cliché, or when we acknowledge that we have a tin ear for irony. I hope it's clear that words like sentimentality, pathos, and others like that I've just referred to, function as the names of critical categories, that is, categories that mark for us what it is to think well or badly. In our efforts to think well, we're answerable to them. Indeed, they partly define what it is to think badly in what I have sometimes in my work called the realm of meaning. That's an area of discourse in which we often say things like, "Don't you understand what it means to be a mortal being? Only now do I see what it really means to love. Don't you understand what it means to humiliate someone as you have done? Don't you understand what it means to be abandoned?" Or imagine someone seriously remorseful who says, "Only now do I understand fully the meaning of what I have done." Thought about almost everything that matters to us occurs in that realm, the realm of meaning, defined as such by the way those critical categories work. I know this is getting a little bit abstract, but it's fundamental now to what I have to say, so I hope you bear with me for another 5 minutes. To fully reveal the significance of this, I must draw your attention to a very important distinction. It's a distinction between, and now I'm just going to take sentimentality as my example. Sentimentality as a cause of the false and sentimentality as a form of the false. Taken as a cause of the false, or more generally as a cause of our not thinking well, it's conceived to function more or less as tiredness or drunkenness or fearlessness or recklessness do. And if we think of sentimentality like that, then it makes sense to wish, as philosophers and other thinkers so often have, that we were the kind of creatures who could rid themselves of these psychological states that disable our capacity for clear, true thought. And important to such an ideal is a conception of thought, of what makes it succeed or fail, that can be articulated without reference to sentimentality or similar afflictions. A conception of the true, the false, and the muddled, a conception of reason, indeed, that we would have if we'd never heard of sentimentality or similar afflictions. Being the psychologically complex creatures we are, this thought continues, We have reluctantly to acknowledge our vulnerability to such states, and we must sometimes refer to those states when we're speculating about the causes of human error. Considered merely as psychological causes of error and muddle, causes of the false, as I put it for simplicity, sentimentality and the other afflictions I've listed are of no intrinsic interest whatsoever to anybody who thinks about thinking. No more interest than headaches or tiredness or drunkenness or fearfulness or vanity or cowardice do. That's why these concepts are never seriously discussed, for example, in classes in moral philosophy. Sometimes reference to sentimentality as a critical concept does function as philosophers assume it does. When it does, it makes sense to try to extract cognitive content from its sentimental form and to assess it for its truth or falsehood independently from that form. It makes sense, for example, to say, look, I suspect what Fred says is false. I suspect it's sentimentality that causes him to say it. Just look at the quality, the purple nature of his prose. But, one goes on to say, that suspicion is in the end irrelevant. What matters is not whether he's sentimental. What matters is whether what he says is true or false. Sometimes, though, and this is absolutely critical to what I want to say, sometimes, though, the extraction of muddled or false content from the form that makes us suspect that sentimentality is the cause of the muddle or falsehood, sometimes that seems to make no sense. Suppose someone to say, and now I'm taking examples relevant to the fact that this lecture is sponsored by Anglicare, suppose someone to say, look, I don't care whether some of the Beatitudes are sentimental. All that matters to me is whether they're morally true or false. Or I know that the Job or the Jesus of this translation seems sometimes to be sentimental or banal, but that doesn't matter. I'm interested in truth, not literature. In such example, it's far from clear what the division between the sentimental from the true and the false come to. In such examples, sentimentality or banality are not only what we would call merely aesthetic concepts, they mark out forms of the false. And taking as forms rather than as causes of the false, reference to them and to the other failings I listed earlier, a vulnerability to pathos, a tinny for irony and so on, when they mark out forms of the false, they mark out a distinctive cognitive realm. And the effort to overcome them is an effort to see things as they are, an effort oriented to truth, but it's an effort in which feeling and thought, form and content, are inseparable. When their forms of the false, vulnerability to sentimentality and so on, are not contingent obstacles to lucidity. They're intrinsic to its distinctively cognitive character. Poets and other writers and artists may wish even more fiercely than scientists to be rid of sentimentality and similar vices. But for a poet to wish to be the kind of creature who is not vulnerable to it, is for her to wish to be free of the only idiom in which she can write poetry. To wish to be free of all that makes us vulnerable to cliché, banality, sentimentality and so on in our moral thought, including much of our philosophical thought about morality, is to wish ourselves bereft of ways of elaborating in what I'm calling the realm of meaning, our full sense, our full understanding of what it means to wrong somebody and almost everything that conditions that sense. If that's true, then philosophical and other kinds of thought about absolute value is in medias res, in the radical way that I've suggested, necessarily answerable to critical categories that define the realm of meaning, categories to which thought in that realm is necessarily answerable, categories which define its distinctively cognitive character. And the same is true of religious thought about absolute value. It's part, I think, of the very idea of religion, part of the concept of it, as it connects with the God of religion at any rate, that someone who professes it or bears witness to it must believe that it deepens rather than cheapens what human beings care for, whether they're religious or not, or even whether they care a fig for morality. We may think that they're wrong when they think it deepens, but they can't say, I know this is sentimental, banal, tone-deaf, to irony, riddled with cliché, disdainful of the world, does the dirt on life, but there it is, it's my religion. I'm not interested in aesthetics, I'm interested in truth. Well, now, it's true that the concepts with which we assess whether something goes deep or not whether it deepens rather than trivializes or cheapens what we care for, are often from one perspective much like a set of categories. It's the banality of the idea that God knows my email address that accounts against it. It's not its illogicality. Or if we treat it as illogical, if we think it makes no sense, then it's because it goes against the grammar, of Wittgenstein would have put it, of our religious ways of speaking, when those ways of speaking are alive to language used at full stretch, imaginatively, creatively, with an ear for tone. And this is especially true of religions like Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, because they are religions in which reflection on the examples of people's lives and deeds and words deepens, or claims to deepen, understanding of what is of religious significance, and indeed of what it is for something to be of religious significance. And that, I believe, is a much richer conception of what it is to think well or badly about matters of religion than the relatively thin conception that's often advocated by people who speak of faith supporting reason. But as I've intimated, though I've not said so explicitly, there's no such thing as reason. There's only thinking well and badly about this or that particular subject matter. And some of the concepts that tell us what it is to think well in one domain may have no application in others at all. I don't know what it would be to suggest that a proposition in physics or mathematics is undermined by cliché, or because only someone tone deaf to irony or banality would advance it. So when I speak of the God of the philosophers contrasting it with the God of religion, I mean by the God of the philosopher the God whose existence and properties is the subject of the kind of speculation that would, if only it could, retreat to a tone-free zone, a zone in which accusations of sentimentality, banality, etc., are as inappropriate, unsuitable to the subject matter, as they are in mathematics or physics. Well, in 2004, I started thinking hard again about talk of inalienable dignity because of September 11th, which I suggested before, prompted people to wonder whether torture might not sometimes be permissible if it saves many lives. And I remarked that almost everybody who thought that it could not be morally justified appealed to the idea that it was a violation. Michael Ignatieff called it the ultimate violation of the dignity of a person. I want now to reflect on that example and on the idea of inalienable dignity and suggest from a particular example that I'm about to read out to you that the concept of inalienable dignity can't take us where we might want to go when we speak of the violation that torture inevitably brings about. I ought to say, I think, that despite the election of President Obama, this is not a topic that has gone away for us, thinking about torture. In his wonderful book, If This Is Man, Primo Levi gives an example. He tells of an incident that occurred during his last weeks in Auschwitz. Russian artillery could already be heard in the camp. After years in the death camp, the prospect of liberation seemed only weeks away. And this is what he writes. The night held ugly surprises. Ludmacher in the bunk under mine was a poor wreck of a man. He was or had been a Dutch Jew, 17 years old, tall, thin and gentle. He'd been in bed for 3 months. I have no idea how he'd managed to survive the selections. He had typhus and scarlet fever successfully. At the time, a serious cardiac illness had shown itself while he was smothered with bed sores, so much so that by now he could only lie on his stomach. Despite all this, he had a ferocious appetite. He only spoke Dutch and none of us could understand him. Perhaps the cause of it all was the cabbage and turnip soup of which Ludmacher had wanted 2 helpings. In the middle of the night, he groaned and then threw himself from his bed. He tried to reach the latrine but was too weak and fell to the ground crying and shouting loudly. Charles lit the lamp and we were able to ascertain the gravity of the incident. The boy's bed and the floor were filthy. The smell in the small area was rapidly becoming insupportable. We had but a minimum supply of water and neither blankets nor straw mattresses to spare. And the poor wretch, suffering from typhus, formed a terrible source of infection. While he could not certainly be left all night to groan and shiver in the cold in the middle of the filth. Charles climbed down from his bed and dressed in silence. While I held the lamp, he cut all the dirty patches from the straw mattress and the blankets with a knife. He lifted Ludmarker from the ground with the tenderness of a mother, cleaned him as best as possible with straw taken from the mattress, and lifted him into the remade bed in the only position in which the unfortunate fellow could lie. He scraped the floor with a scrap of tin plate, diluted a little chloramine, and finally spread disinfectant over everything and over himself. End of quote. More often than not, when moral philosophers discuss an example like this, they do it to illustrate the concept of a supererogatory act, an act that is beyond the call of duty. It's, of course, easy to see why what Charles did should be called supererogatory, because it is supererogatory. But the thought that he did something beyond the call of duty need not be what first strikes one. Instead, one might be struck by, or to put it better, one might wonder at the goodness, the kind that sometimes makes us reach for a capital G. And such wonder might be informed less by the fact that Charles risked his own life after years in Auschwitz, with freedom probably only weeks away for the sake of a man certain to die within days, less by that than by the fact that he was able to respond with the tenderness of a mother. Without doubt, Charles was an extraordinary man, but I'm disinclined to describe his capacity to respond so remarkably to Ludmarker as a moral feat, a feat of moral character, for example. The concept of character, I think, can't reach what's at issue here, not at any rate if it's interdependent with virtues of character. If one wanted to say that his behaviour expressed the virtue of charity to a superlative degree, then it would be a conception of charity that's already informed by a sense of Ludmarker, as that was revealed in Charles's behaviour towards him. It would not explain that sense of Ludmarker. At the risk of being misleading, I'll say that my point is conceptual. It's about the concepts that must be available to us if we're to see things in a certain way. In this case, if we're to see people who are radically afflicted in a way that enables us even to find intelligible that one could respond with a compassion to them that is without a trace of condescension. Such compassion is something to wonder at, but only because of what it reveals about what elicits it. And when we wonder at such compassion, our attention is less on the people who show it than it is on what they show. I'd make the same point about empathy, which is nowadays such a prized virtue. It was not Charles's capacity for empathy that was wondrous, not at any rate if that empathy refers to his capacity to see things and to feel things as Ludmarker did. We're told nothing about how Ludmarker saw things, but it wouldn't be surprising if his affliction had made him numb and if years of degradation had made him capable of any serious conception of his intrinsic worth as a human being, of his inalienable dignity, as Kant would put it. To be sure, Charles responded to Ludmarker's condition, but he responded to what it means for a human being to have fallen into that condition, rather than what it felt like, how it appeared from the inside, so to speak. I hope, therefore, that you'll see why I placed the emphasis on how wondrous it is that Charles could see Ludmarker as he did, rather on what Charles subjectively felt when he saw Ludmarker lying on the floor, or on the impressiveness of risking typhus weeks or even days before liberation for the sake of a man who was certain to die. The wonder of what Charles did is that he responded fully to Ludmarker's degradation, saw fully the depth of it, while affirming that Ludmarker was precious. For that, I believe, is what the quality of his tenderness revealed. And for that reason, I suggest that we do what comes naturally and call the understanding that was shown in Charles's tenderness as a form of love. And for that reason, I believe it's more than a cheap shot to point out that it looks like a parody rather than philosophical clarification to say that Charles responded to the imperative to treat every human being as a rational creature. If we take our wonder at the fact that Charles responded to Ludmarker with the tenderness of a mother as wonder directed not so much to Charles but to what his tenderness revealed about Ludmarker, then it would seem absurd to say that our wonder was that even in those terrible circumstances, Ludmarker could inspire the respect that is owed to rational agency. While the claim that Charles responded to Lautmacher as to a rational creature invites parody, the claim that he saw in him a dignity that is inalienable does not, and indeed for at least two reasons it seems the right thing to say. Firstly, it seems to explain why our attention is not on Charles, but on what his behaviour reveals about Lautmacher, namely that he possessed a kind of dignity from which even his extreme degradation could not alienate him. And it explains, too, why Kant was right to think that compassion, considered as a natural disposition, cultivated even to a superlative degree, could not of itself bring one to respond to someone as to a being who possessed a dignity that's inalienable and to which everyone owes unconditional respect. I'll put the point this way, a way, in fact, that Kant would deplore. Compassion is not for the suffering as such that a human being undergoes. It's for the human being who suffers, and that can't at any times be separated from one's understanding of what it means to be a human being, living a human life. And if one believes, to put it again in a Kantian idiom, that human beings possess inalienable dignity, then compassion that is informed by that belief will at all times be different from the compassion of someone who does not have that belief, even when that belief is not to the fore. But if that's right, if I'm right to say that it's love rather than reason whose grasp of the categorical imperative was not clouded by temptation or exhaustion, that showed wondrously in Charles's demeanour, and that this love showed itself in the quality of his tenderness, that he responded to Lautmacher with the tenderness of a mother, if all that is right, then to say that he responded to Lautmacher's inherent dignity is, I think, to speak in the wrong key, the heroic and the noble key, in which Kant so often moves us. Dignity is essentially tied to appearances and is essentially alienable. The ties that bind it to appearances can be loosened, but they can't all be cut. We can and we should develop a generous understanding of the conditions under which dignity is visible. We can learn and indeed become astonished at how much dignity survives the degradation of the body and to some degree even of the mind. But there are limits. Misfortune can be so severe, criminals can be so unrelentingly cruel, that some people are, as Simone Weil puts it, struck one of those blows that leaves a human being writhing on the ground like a half-crushed worm. That happened to Lautmacher. And then, I believe, only the love of saints, or love of the kind shown by Charles, can see and reveal the full humanity in them. And it's one of the reasons why survivors of torture find it so difficult fully to acknowledge themselves to be the same person as the one who was tortured. And it's why Simone Weil also said that compassion for the affliction is a more astounding miracle than walking on water, healing the sick, or raising the dead. There are nonetheless good reasons why torture is rightly condemned as an offence against human dignity. Not inalienable dignity, not dignity with a big D, just ordinary dignity. In A Common Humanity, I said that a concern for justice was in large part a concern that our institutions encourage us to see, and in seeing to be fully responsive to the full humanity of our fellow citizens. More often than not, our institutions fail in this, but it's a demand we make not only of saints, we make it of our fellow citizens. We make, and it's essential to the institutions of civil society, that we make it of our fellow citizens. Forms of punishment, for example, we think should be limited to those to which a prisoner should consent without degrading herself, in part because we require them to be administered in ways that are respectful of her humanity. Much the same is true of killing in war. Torture, either as a means of getting information or as a form of punishment or social control, can never satisfy that requirement. If I'm right to say that the humanity of a radically degraded victim of torture is fully visible only to love, to saintly love, or to love of the kind that Charles showed to Lautmacher, then a torturer could not be morally horrified by what he was doing, and at the same time, believing it to be his duty, respect the humanity of the person he's torturing. But it is essential to the very idea that torture is a lesser evil that we might be obliged to commit, It's essential to that idea that we can fully understand the evil we do to a person whom we torture. That, I've suggested, is possible only if we fully understand the wrong that we inflict on that person, the wrong that she suffers, which, as I claimed earlier, is an irreducible source of her torment. And that's possible, I think, only if the person's humanity remains fully visible to us. Were we to put the point in a Kantian idiom, we'd say that torture could be seriously conceived as a lesser evil only if torturers could accord to their victim the unconditional respect owed to each human being while at the same time torturing them. If I've been right to suggest that reflection on our wonder at the deeds of people like Charles shows what's wrong with Kantian elaborations of that noble phrase, the unconditional respect owed to all human beings, then it's an illusion, I think, to believe that torture could be a lesser evil, fully understood as that by the torturer. For that reason, even if it's whistling in the dark to posit an inalienable dignity that supposedly not even torture can touch, we should be more respectful than we are of the dignity that is essentially alienable. In the world of politics, no one should be so alienated from their ordinary, alienable dignity that only a saint or someone possessing the kind of wondrous capacity of a Charles, that only such a person could see the full humanity in them. Thank you.
Professor Guider, thank you so much for a wonderfully thought-provoking address this afternoon. Before I invite questions in just a moment, I have to remind everyone of the tight timeline that the festival runs on, and I'm asked two things. One is Professor Guider is going to be part of a 3 o'clock session, which requires that this room be cleared as quickly as possible after we finish at 2:45. And the secondly, because he is preparing for that session, he is not going to be able to sign any books that people might have brought with them today. Now, turning now to the topic that he has spoken to us about, the idea of absolute value, are there any questions? And I gather there's a microphone in the middle of the room there. Well, in fact, I want to ask a question at this stage myself, Professor Guider. You talked about the concept of, middle terms mingle incorrigibly, and this issue of sentimentality as opposed to the depth of meaning. In your book, in fact, Good and Evil and Absolute Conception, you make some fascinating context about that language and some of the other circumstances of language that give rise to that language help us give meaning to the terms that go beyond the banal, beyond pathos. You actually make a comment, I think, that Esperanto would not be suitable for conveying a deeper, serious moral meaning, other than perhaps a utilitarian view that Kant might propose. Can you just explore a little more that issue of how we can make those interrelationships of language and its genesis and our understanding of human concepts of morality and good and evil?
Well, there are two. There's a big divide in philosophy, and that is between philosophers who take art seriously and philosophers who don't, for the most part. All philosophers, of course, think that most philosophers will at least concede that art can present classes in moral philosophy with good examples, intricate plots, and so on. But there is this very deep idea that informs not only philosophers' understanding of reason, but right outside of philosophy. It informs the way people sometimes contrast reason and emotion, for example. There's this very deep idea that insofar as we can learn from art, insofar as it has anything to offer the understanding, as opposed to edification, pleasure, and so on, insofar as it has anything to offer the understanding, we have to extract from the particular form of the art, whether it be a poem or a novel or a film, we have to extract what is its proper cognitive content, the content that is really suitable for the work of understanding, and then think about that with a conception of reason that could in principle make no reference to that form. That's a very, very deep idea. And it's the idea that is often expressed. I mean, Peter Singer expresses this idea, for example, that we should aim to think from the standpoint of the universe, that is, from a standpoint radically disengaged from everything that conditions a particular way of living, in this case, the living of human beings with particular histories, with a particular art, and so on. Now, I think, as I've tried to suggest, that that's mistaken. Why is it important outside of esoteric discussions? Well, first of all, it's fundamental to trying to understand, I mean, thinking out this issue is fundamental to understand what kind of thinking one should be doing or trying to do, what one's ideal of good thinking would be when one's thinking about all those matters that I say belong to the realm of meaning. Moral matters, of course, but what counts as real love? What would count as the difference between real mourning as opposed to sentimental self-indulgence? And so on. So it matters to that. And it matters supremely to us, I think, that international law is so deeply moral, insofar as it has a moral content, that content is deeply embedded in Kantian idioms. And those idioms have had a very profound effect on us. They're moving, they're inspiring. We talk about the inalienable dignity that's owed to every human being. Okay? But if you think of how someone like Kant himself and how philosophers want to explain all that, they move in one direction and talk, in fact, about what is owed to rational agency, what is owed to us essentially as rational beings. That doesn't have to be a human being, doesn't even have to be a creature. Anything that is a rational being is owed that unconditional respect. And that becomes very, very abstract and is formulated in language which has no capacity to move us at all. And Kant would say, that's right, we shouldn't be moved here. What's interesting, though, is that when those terms, actually you see this happening in international law, mingle with other ones like the human family, our common humanity, phrases that are resonant with sort of artistic illusion and so on. And when one thinks about that development of them, if one asks, oh, come on, don't talk about the human family, that's a bit of a kitsch way of talking about. When one talks like that, one has then to appeal to what I call those categories that define the realm of meaning. Then we say something like, oh, you really have to be kitsch to fall back on that phrase, or you really have to be sentimental to be taken in by that one. Philosophers have always accepted that you say these sort of things, and that's why they've been suspicious of art. They think it hits below the intellectual belt all the time. But what I've been suggesting is that if we think of the criticism of that's a sentimental thought that you're having as saying that's a form of the false, then we mark out a distinctive realm for the understanding. Not a realm just for feeling, but a realm for the understanding. I don't know how... Given that so much of our really important thinking about international law is embedded in a Kantian idiom, if we feel we can't develop it in a Kantian direction, and if we feel that the conception of reason that lay behind Kant's desire to develop in the direction he did, if we can't do that and we can't find any other way of expressing what we've left to fill that gap, we're in a real cultural crisis, I think. We have to find a new way of speaking of what, if we think that talk of inalienable dignity, when it's finally philosophically characterized, leads only to parody. My God, what have I done, says the torturer. I violated rationality, some rational agency. That sounds to me like a parody. It can't take you the depth of understanding of what it means to wrong somebody. But if we think that, and we can't think of any other way to develop this thought, and there's no other way in the mainstream of the philosophical tradition, we are in trouble. Religious people, of course, had a way of putting it. I'm not religious, and by the way. And they said, well, every human being is sacred. And I think Alan Donegan was right to say that Kant was trying to render perspicuous to reason the intellectual content of the command to love one's neighbour, where one's neighbour was just taken in Christianity to be someone sacred. If the Kantian elaboration fails, I say, and if you're not religious, as I'm not religious, what do you do? I used to talk, I'm now embarrassed by it a bit, I used to talk about the inalienable preciousness of every human being. But that has all sorts of inadequacies too. It sounds to be in the wrong key to speak that way about Saddam or about Kant or about Eichmann, to take the example. It sounds precious. Maybe a saint could say just that, but most of us can't without being pretentious or precious. So it's not an abstruse matter for academic philosophy that we have inherited such a powerful, rhetorically powerful idiom from a philosopher who, in a way, despised the rhetorical power of it and what we have made of it. Keep moving in my earpiece.
Now, I'm afraid because we do have to be preparing for the next session at 3 o'clock, we will probably have to conclude the session at this point on that. There have been so many things that you have left us with today. I don't know where to begin, and I therefore best not go through too many of them. But I found such things, you know, you did not use the phrase there, but for the grace of God go I. But you've taken my reflection on that to a much deeper level, away from that concept of altruistic self-interest. By really saying a phrase like that, I think does not address the issues that you've been talking about, that inherent concept of a human being becomes the more significant issue to be dealing with. And the way, for example, you looked at the question of empathy and how that word should be drilled down deeper so that we actually are not empathizing with the suffering per se, but with the human being. So it means to look at what it means to be in such a condition rather than what it feels like to us. So I just could go on at great length and don't have the time in which to do so today. The concept of absolute value is surely something that is always before us as a challenge. You have given us the question of the current debates on torture and whether this is an idea of a lesser evil, or to use what you talk about in the book, Socrates' phrase, if we know what evil is, we cannot do it. How does that kind of apply in that situation? I guess one final comment I might make is you've quoted Primo Levi, and I wonder about Viktor Frankl, and if you've ever thought through the different ways in which they came from essentially the same experience and sought for meaning, and how each of those did that. Anyway, that's not what you're here is to hear my reflections on the issue. We're here to have heard Professor Raymond Geiter, and I now ask you in joining with me in acknowledging with great appreciation what we have heard today.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2009 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Barsmith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.